Please be seated. The next case for oral argument is Dublin District et al. Appellants versus Richard Milner and others, appellees. For the appellant, we have Mr. Stephen Sandman, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Reed Rasmussen, an attorney from Aberdeen. The court would like to welcome high school students from Leola High School and Sully Buttes High School and hope you find it informative. With that, Mr. Sandman, you may proceed. You have 20 minutes, sir.
Good morning, Justices. Chief Justice, I enjoyed your story on the four-legged skunk at the 2012 message. Very entertaining. I had the honor of representing some seniors, a political subdivision of the System Wahpeton Oyate, the Veblen District. Some of the folks are here today. One of the plaintiffs has passed away in 2008, health issues. The big issue for us here today, Justices, and with the reason that we think that the wrong material facts or the wrong test has been applied for a motion for summary judgment, is that the motion for summary judgment, the motion to dismiss, was filed before our amended answer. We went ahead and filed our first complaint on November 20th, 2007, and it had eight counts in it. Only one of those counts, breach of fiduciary duty, was contained in any of the others, in the amended complaint that was filed on January 24th, 2008. The new counts that were put in the amended complaint in making a determination of what facts are material were, one, oppression, two, breach of fiduciary duty, that was the only count that was the same as the first complaint, three, tortious interference, four, restraint of trade, five, negligence, and six, unjust enrichment. We went ahead and amended the complaint before any responsive pleading was filed. We all know that a motion to dismiss isn't a responsive pleading. And we went ahead pursuant to 15-6-15A of civil procedure to go ahead where a party may amend his pleading once as a matter of course at any time before a responsive pleading is served. That happened here. When you look at the hearing transcript, when you look at the order, you don't see that the material facts being addressed or being specific to the new counts in the amended pleading. That didn't happen.
Doesn't the judgment granting summary judgment, though, reference the amended complaint?
Right, but it didn't go through the elements of oppression that this court has cited in Landstrom v. Shaver.
Right. If this is summary judgment, does the trial court have to do that?
Yes, they do, Judge. They have to go to the elements. They have to go to the elements of the counts to determine what facts are material. If they go to the wrong counts, they're following the wrong rule. They're going to the wrong elements. How do they make a determination on what rule is applicable to determining what material facts should be considered here? And that didn't happen. The motion for summary judgment was even filed before the amended complaint was filed. In the amended complaint, there were five brand new counts that weren't even included in the original complaint.
Okay.
All right. And some of the disputed facts are dealing with oppression. In Landstrom v. Shaver, a 1997 case before this court, oppressive actions were defined to have referred to conduct that substantially defeat the reasonable expectations held by minority shareholders in committing their capital to a particular enterprise. On pages 12 through 15 of the appellate brief, we go through and walk through what some of those material facts are that go ahead and satisfy those elements that are specific to going ahead and proving up oppression, which is one of the counts in the second complaint. Some of those material facts, disputed material facts, go ahead and include on January 27th, the board terminated a contract that Gerald Person had for raising heifers for MCC Dairy and gave the job to RNG Dairy O Dakota Heifers. The same day, the memberships of appellants, Ralph and Mary Ellen Kynes and Gerald Person, were terminated by the board. As punished, and I go through also on the bottom of page 14 of the brief, as punishment for going ahead and filing this particular lawsuit, the MCC dairy bylaws did not allow any individual to have more than three votes. So what we did and what we have key material facts that demonstrate that appellees went ahead and stacked the vote, added the additional votes with family members so they could go ahead and dissolve this particular corporation.
Let me ask you about these facts. What year did these, the facts that you contend are material to support these causes of action, what year did they occur in?
The facts on going ahead and transferring the shares and
the things that you
stack in the deck, yep, those facts go ahead, and those happened the year the complaint was filed.
It was the
TRO when the original complaint was filed, Judge.
Well, let me put it to you this way: are all the material disputed facts that you're relying on, did they all occur, or did any of them occur prior to March of 2001? Or did they occur after March of 2001?
The vast majority of the material facts occurred after 2001, Your Honor. They occurred, the dissolution of the corporation occurred, that TRO that was filed by us was pending at the same time that the original complaint, or the complaint was filed at about the same time.
Okay, then my next question is, that's the case. Isn't it true that in March of 2001, a majority of the members acting pursuant to the bylaws removed either all or most of the board of directors, including the plaintiffs?
From the board of directors, they maintained their status as minority shareholders, where the majority shareholders had these obligations to them.
Okay.
And you're saying most of the complaints, actual complaint about, occurred after that board change?
Absolutely, Judge. And they're dealing with the majority shareholders breaching.
Everything is okay as far as you're concerned until the board changes and then all these misfortunes start occurring.
Right, with the original complaint, and what you see in the original complaint on how it was pled, was the shareholders, the minority shareholders, were seeking information. They were seeking information to go ahead so they could see what was going on. They weren't learning about an administrative building over here being transferred, or a Prairie Ridge Management, a management group being formed. A lot of these decisions made by the majority shareholders, they were trying to find out information on that. And that was the purpose for filing the original complaint. Learning more shortly after the original complaint was filed, they went ahead and amended their complaint with the counts that I just described.
Okay, thank you.
In addition, in the second count, we're dealing with a breach of fiduciary duty. And the breaches of fiduciary duty, this was learned shortly after filing the shareholder derivative complaint, shortly before the amended complaint was filed, going ahead and dealing with... On April 25th, 2007, the MCC Dairy Board of Directors went ahead and formed this Prairie Ridge Management Company, which went ahead, and the minority shareholders that I'm representing only had an interest in MCC Dairy. And then these other dairies were acquired, and Prairie Ridge Management was put over all the dairies. While the majority owners, for the most part, had ownership interest in the other dairies, and the minority interests did not, this Prairie Ridge Management was formed, and that went ahead and set up this structure that went ahead and caused a lot of problems. They learned that there was a failure to maintain accurate financial records. you know, shortly after the derivative suit was happened, they learned that there weren't even any financial accounting controls, even though you had all these multiple dairies. And they learned about some of the segregation, and you see that later on in the forensic audit that was issued by the receiver for that six-month window. But what you see there is that there wasn't clear segregation between the different dairies, and that MCC dairy was picking up the tab for these other dairies. And all those material facts that on pass-through accounts and the things that you go ahead and read in the forensic audit go ahead and are material to show a breach of that fiduciary duty. There you see the commingling of assets in the housing between employees. These different dairies that were formed each require the same things. They require feed. You see the leasing lot that was shared among the dairies. You see the housing for employees that was shared among the dairies.
If you are successful in getting a reversal from this court on a summary judgment, what relief are you seeking? Are you going to go back and try to get damages? Do you want control of the corporation? Where would your clients want this suit to go?
To go back and get damages, Judge.
Okay.
Okay?
So they're not seeking control of the corporation anymore.
No, we're going back to seek damages. Right. And just Chief Justice, one of the problems that we have in this motion for summary judgment is there was a 3-year stay that was imposed by the receiver going through and doing the forensic audit. The day that forensic audit was completed and the stay was lifted and the court went ahead and allowed this case to go ahead and proceed, we filed our written request for discovery. There has been no responses to any of our written discovery. All right, we would like to be able to proceed through discovery. All right, and we believe that we have enough disputed material facts to get through.
Well, did you make a motion under Rule 56? Rule 56 has a very specific provision that if discovery is not completed, you need to make a motion to develop more facts. And did you? I think it's 56F, year F, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Did you make that motion?
Yeah, we had an omnibus motion that went ahead and dealt with all the different issues that were pending during that 3-year stay and that had been stopped.
Well, did you make the Rule 56 motion?
No, Justice.
Because discovery had not been completed.
No, Justice raised this issue in the hearing for this particular motion on June 6th, explained it in our briefing, in our opposition to the motion for summary judgment to the lower court.
So did you ask for a continuance then of the summary judgment hearing so that you could complete discovery before going on?
I asked that at the June 6th hearing, and the judge was of the opinion that that should have happened prior to the motion for summary judgment hearing, that was held there, and I didn't go ahead and... Yet on this particular issue, I didn't make a motion specific to that matter.
All right. So when you say there was no responses to discovery, did you make a motion to compel discovery before the court so that you could force them to answer the questions?
No, Justice.
Okay.
Some of the other disputed material facts dealing with tortious interference, Your Honors. Justice, you know the test from Tibbet v. McDougall, 479 Northwest 2nd, in 1992. One of the things that was just huge that we raised over and over and over in some of the matters down below was the EB-5 monies. And this fits into this tortious interference. This fits into the breach of fiduciary care. This corporation, MCC Dairy, was dissolved because they didn't, evidently one of the reasons was they didn't have the assets to continue. $13.5 million went from MCC Dairy over to these other corporations, over to these other ventures. Even though that this issue was originally discussed with the board, even though that MCC was eligible for this EB-5 funding, even though MCC Dairy, my clients, had went ahead and paid for some of the consulting, some of the travel, and some of the things with investigating that particular function. So this immigration reform, that could have been a $13.5 million infusion of capital into MCC instead of dissolving it, if there hadn't been a breach of the majority shareholders' duties. There's also an issue on whether or not the elements or the material facts related to restraint of trade or commerce are in dispute. One of the things that we talked about on page 25 of our brief is this integrated system with MCC Dairy, where MCC was at the hub and picking up a lot of the costs that were going on for some of the other dairies. Some of the other dairies are getting profits based upon MCC Dairy going ahead and picking up some of their operating costs and it coming out of them. You see from the forensic audit that occurred during the stay, that occurred from the receiver, it only covered a six-month window. And what it found was that there were 13 different entities that had 189 pass-through transactions. I didn't know what a pass-through transaction, but basically I learned from the forensic audit and going through some of the limited discovery that there was, is that MCC was basically a bank. Some of the money went into MCC, they would pay the bills for some of these other dairies, and then some of the time they wouldn't get paid back for delayed time. They wouldn't get paid back interest. But there were 157 instances totaling, according to the court's limited forensic audit report over a six-month period, of over $330,000 where a pass-through invoice was paid by MCC Dairy for expenses incurred by someone other than MCC Dairy. And remember, justices, there was no fiduciary controls. There was no accounting mechanism in place. There were multiple examples of failure to go ahead and segregate which expenses are which. There were 29 instances from this limited forensic report where reimbursement was not made until after 30 days or more for pass-through payments. 14 pass-through transactions lacked even a reference number, so they couldn't even figure out where the money, you know, came out of what particular account, where it went to. And they were unable to trace the number of days before reimbursement by these other dairies, where the minority shareholders had no interest, but the majority shareholders did here. We learned from the forensic audit about $47,988. Outside the forensic examination, they identified lease payments from the feed facility of $30,000 per month. And remember, that was a feed facility that was supposed to be for MCC Dairy, that was started by MCC Dairy, owned by MCC Dairy, and then it was went ahead and it was leased out to other dairies where my minority shareholders didn't have an interest. And they went ahead, and there was no references even in that feed center on how MCC Dairy would use that.
Were these disputed facts put in the forensic audit before the circuit court?
Yeah, the circuit court had the forensic audit. The circuit court ordered this forensic audit.
But was it part of the proceeding?
Yeah, at the motion for summary judgment, we raised these issues regarding the forensic audit. We had this summary. It was part of the record. One of the things that we learned also, you know, that there was no interest for these pass-through accounts. So MCC Dairy is at the hub of this integrated dairy system where the minority shareholders don't have an interest in the rest of the integrated system, but they're picking up the tab for all these other areas. And there's no dispute on the different ownership interests with the majority shareholders in the other dairies. There's no dispute that there was no segregation of controls, and that this forensic audit is an accurate snapshot of a six-month window where they found all this wrongdoing. All right. So even without written discovery proceeding, that forensic audit in itself fits into those five new counts that are part of the amended complaint that weren't included in the shareholder, specifically in the shareholder derivative action. With a minute remaining, justices, on the sanction matter, the one thing that I would like to point out is that pursuant 15-6-37B goes ahead and provide, you got to provide notice for a deposition. What is proper notice? And we see from the record at one, that one of the notices from the June 6, 2011 hearing transcript, you see on page 8, lines 24 and 25, that any notice was sent via facsimile.
Was that the first time? Was that the first notices or the second ones? So I know you objected to the location of where this was going to be. Were the notices, the first notices, proper, or were they all done by fax?
No, we never went ahead and agreed to fax service by facsimile.
Right, I know what I mean.
The proceeding. But the facts regarding the change of location, a lot of the elders I represented didn't want to do the deposition in the bar.
Right.
We got a fax the day before.
I understand that.
At 112.
I understand that was faxed. But was the previous notice to the bar, was that faxed too, or was that mail? Was that sent to you properly?
For the amended location?
No, for the original location.
The original location, it was our understanding, it didn't mention, yeah, it was mailed, Justice.
It was properly sent to you the first time. The second time, when you objected to the bar and that you got a new location, that was sent by fax.
Yes, Justice.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sandman. Your time has expired, sir. Mr. Rasmussen, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Please support, counsel. MCC Dairy proved to be a bad investment for everyone, not just the minority shareholders, but the majority shareholders also. And unfortunately, in a situation like this, factions develop. People are blaming others for the fact that this thing lost money. The major dispute started in 2002 when several of the plaintiffs initiated a criminal investigation, which resulted in a search warrant being executed. Computers were taken, all the records were taken, caused tremendous financial distress for MCC. Attorney General, the investigation found no evidence of criminal wrongdoing. But the plaintiffs didn't give up. They then initiated this derivative lawsuit in 2007.
Well, doesn't the acrimony really start when there's the shift on the board in 2001?
Yeah, I think that. Yeah, I agree. And they were there, and there was acrimony before that. I mean, there were problems that developed, and everybody on the board, which included some of the both minority and majority shareholders, everybody was knocked off the board at that point. A new board was formed. Then the criminal investigation came. And then we eventually, and things continued. Between 2002 and 2007, there was still acrimony.
So the 2001, the entire board's wiped out and a new board comes in.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Every plaintiff was deposed. Every one of them that was listed in the original complaint, every one of them talked about rumors, suspicion, and innuendo, that they heard on the street that things were wrong, that they heard this, they heard that. A lot of those things are the same things that they're now claiming are disputed material facts. But not one of those plaintiffs could point to any evidence which proved that any of the defendants had misappropriated funds, breached fiduciary duty, or did anything else that supported the multitude of claims that was set forth in that original complaint.
That isn't really the way we look at summary judgment. We look at it on the basis of the entire record, not whether the plaintiff has personal knowledge. If they can establish a question of fact through an admission, through documents, that's enough, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree. But they didn't do that either.
The forensic accounting, the counsel just said now, the forensic accounting alone proves much of their case.
That's totally untrue. The forensic audit, and he made the comment that the forensic audit showed evidence of wrongdoing. That is totally incorrect. The forensic audit specifically says there's no finding of fraud. All of these pass-through accounts that he talked about, every one of those, that's true. MCC paid for things. They were reimbursed for every single one of them. The other thing he talked about, various other things with regard to, no interest was charged. That's true also. MCC had relationships with these other dairies. They didn't charge these other dairies interest. but the other dairies didn't charge MCC interest either. And the evidence showed that if the dairies had all charged each other interest, it would have cost MCC more money. And so it was actually an advantage to MCC. Judge Von Wall had full access to the forensic audit and found that there simply is no issue of fact raised by that forensic audit. It didn't support the plaintiff's claim whatsoever. The claim here is that, for purposes of the summary judgment hearing, I told Judge Von Wall, we will acknowledge that every fact that they're claiming, we'll acknowledge it's true. We're not disputing any of those facts. The simple fact of the matter is that none of those facts establish any wrongdoing. A couple of things that were mentioned, there was a reference to the Kintzes being removed from the board. There was a reference to one of the plaintiffs losing a contract with MCC. We're not disputing any of that. It's all true. It's referenced in the minutes. But none of it's wrongdoing. And that's where it got to the point where we're trying in those depositions to figure out, well, what is it you're claiming that the plaintiffs or the defendants did wrong? And none of the plaintiffs could identify anything. And now they come in, and the main thrust of their argument before this court is that, well, we filed our motion for summary judgment before the amended complaint was filed, and, you know, that changed everything. We filed that motion for summary judgment in January of 2008. Because of the stay related to the receivership, we didn't get to the court for a hearing until March, or until 2011. They didn't file their response to our motion for summary judgment with our own statement of, in response to our statement of undisputed facts, until May of 2011. But between the time of those original depositions and the time they responded to the summary judgment motion, they didn't file one additional affidavit. They didn't come in with an expert witness who says, I've reviewed this forensic audit and there's findings of impropriety here. None of the plaintiffs came in and said, oh, now we know. Now we have additional facts. Now, yes, we know clearly that there was wrongdoing here. None of that occurred. And they make the claim that, well, the original lawsuit was only to get records. That's totally unsupported. The original lawsuit, the derivative lawsuit, has virtually the same claims. They changed the heading of the counts, but the claims are the same. I mean, in fact, we filed a pleading with Judge Von Wall, which compared the original complaint and the amended complaint, and a lot of the paragraphs are repeated, but the basic allegations are the same. In fact, in their brief, page one of their brief before this court, the plaintiffs state that they filed the derivative complaint, quote, based upon the individual appellee's improper conduct with regard to their control and management of the dairy. That's a reference to the original complaint. That's the same thing that's alleged in the amended complaint. And they simply have no facts to support it. This whole case is pages and pages of complaints and written arguments and statements by plaintiff's counsel that there's all this wrongdoing, yet we admit to the facts and simply said to Judge Von Wall, here's the facts. There's no evidence of any wrongdoing. And he couldn't find any, and they haven't produced any. The other thing that's important is that this argument about the judge not relying on the amended complaint and not looking at the specific counts that were arrested in that amended complaint was never raised before the trial court. The first time that argument is raised is in the brief to this court. You can look at that transcript of that summary judgment hearing. It's 58 pages long. 35 pages is plaintiff's counsel arguing, and not once does he say, Judge, you know, we've got new counts in this amended complaint. That's what you've got to look at. You've got to reassess everything. You have to discount the deposition testimony because it was taken before the amended complaint was filed. Nothing. It's a whole new argument that was never presented to the trial court, and obviously, because of that, it's our position that it should be rejected out of hand. Again, the audit that was conducted, which was initiated because of a separate lawsuit that was started, receivership was instituted. That audit was done. It found nothing. It simply found nothing. And for the plaintiffs to stand up here and say that it showed wrongdoing is a total misstatement. There is absolutely no evidence in this entire record, no witnesses, no affidavits. The audit itself shows no evidence of fraud or wrongdoing on the part of the plaintiffs. And that's true of the rest of the record. The plaintiff's brief is full of various allegations. A lot of times, it cites no specific facts to support a lot of those allegations. This big blue notebook here is one of the exhibits. And if you read the brief, you'll see that it's cited numerous times by the plaintiff, but they don't tell you where to look in it. It just says, clerk's record 2870. And you're supposed to go through that and try to find where some of these things are. It's a lot of unsupported allegations. The plaintiff's reply brief cites deposition testimony that's not part of the record in this case. This entire case has been, let's throw things against the wall, and if we throw enough paper at the judges or at the judge, he's not going to grant summary judgment. And I think that's the same theory here with the Supreme Court, is if we throw enough up there and say all these bad things are going on and people lost money, there has to be something there, and we should be allowed to proceed with our lawsuit. I think Judge Von Wald carefully considered the record in this case. He had pages and pages of documents to look at, and he went through those, and he considered the deposition of the plaintiffs, of all the plaintiffs, and the records that were in existence, and he found that there was no issues of material fact. He looked at our statement of undisputed material facts, a number of which were admitted by the plaintiffs, and also considered that we had acknowledged that for purposes of the summary judgment hearing, we'll agree that every fact they're stating is true, and there simply is just no evidence of any wrongdoing. This
that went to their statement of material facts as well.
Yes, yes, yeah. For that purposes of the summary judgment, I said, well, I'll acknowledge every one of those things is true. And still, if you read that, all it is, again, is all these allegations. Well, these guys were associated with all these other dairies. We think there must have been something bad going on. This other dairy made a lot of money, and MCC didn't make a lot of money, so that must mean that these majority shareholders were doing something wrong. And the depositions of some of the plaintiffs were particularly significant in that they're trying to put the burden of proof on us. I mean, they would be asked, well, what specific information do you have? Well, I don't have any, but you guys have to prove to me that you didn't do anything wrong. Well, that's not. They've got the burden of proof, and they haven't met that burden of proof. They have not shown enough to survive the summary judgment motion. I fully recognize that summary judgment is not necessarily a favored motion, but a plaintiff has to meet the motion and show the court some facts which are really in dispute, that are material facts that are in dispute, and they have not done that. This thing has been going on for over 10 years. In their brief, in the reply brief on page 1, the plaintiffs state that the defendants, quote, rehash their trite and antiquated arguments about lack of personal knowledge, end quote. I don't think those arguments are trite and antiquated. I agree with Chief Justice Gilbertson that the testimony of the plaintiff isn't the only thing you look at, but certainly it's important. And they can't point to anything. And their documents don't point to anything. They lost money, no question. That's true. So did the majority shareholders in this deal. It was a bad deal. But as mentioned in the Landstrom case, just because things don't work out as everybody hoped doesn't mean there's been oppression or fraud, and doesn't make a case. They have not brought forward anything that supports their multitude of allegations, and for those reasons, the summary judgment motion should be affirmed. This dispute has gone on long enough, and it should end at this point in time. With regard to the motion for sanctions, just briefly on that, again, as with the argument about the new complaint, this argument about a faxed notice, the first time that argument has ever been made was in the plaintiff's reply brief. They didn't even make it in their original brief. I've had no chance to respond to that. Never brought before the trial court. Never raised at all until that reply brief. The fact of the matter is, just to clarify the question that Justice Konenkamp asked, the original notices were properly served, and then there was these ongoing conversations between the MCC counsel and Mr. Sandvin, and you know the eventual dispute came down that they didn't like the fact that this was being held in a quote-unquote bar. Well, actually, it was held in a room that was part of the same building. It wasn't in the bar itself. But nevertheless, MCC's counsel agreed to change it, and at that point, that's when the faxed notice was sent out. But the original notices were totally proper. They did not submit any objection to the findings of our proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law. They didn't submit their own. So I think the only question for this court is whether the findings support the conclusions of law, and I think they clearly do. The judge considered all the facts and properly awarded sanctions. Just want to comment on a couple of other things that were raised in the questioning of plaintiff's counsel. With regard to this issue of request for further discovery, that was brought up at the hearing. Judge Von Wald asked plaintiff's counsel, page 44 of the transcript, "Are you telling me that what you're really trying to do is to do additional discovery so you can solidify the evidence in your case to support your claims?" The response was, that's why we made written discovery requests, Judge, but we can go ahead and satisfy the motion for summary judgment standard as of today because of these disputed facts with these exhibits that are here now. So Judge Von Wald gave them the opportunity, if they wanted to ask for additional time. I probably would have objected to it, and I don't know what would have happened, but they didn't ask for it. And there was no Rule 56 motion, as Justice Zinta referenced. They decided to go ahead with what was in existence at that time. So, again, in the end, I think if there are no further questions, I just urge the court to review this record carefully and affirm Judge Von Wald's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rasmussen. Mr. Sandvin, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Looking at pages 11 of 12 of the conclusion of the forensic audit that is part of the record, it's got a conclusion in it from the forensic auditor that is part of the record. $67,156 of MCC Dairy-related pass-through expenses and $333,000 and change of MCC Dairy-related pass-through expenses incurred by MCC Dairy. No interest was charged to these entities. Number two, no interest was received or paid on loans between MCC Dairy and other dairies. Number three, an additional 28 instances of MCC Dairy-related pass-through expenses totaling $47,988 occurred outside the examination period. 29 instances where pass-through expenses were reimbursed to MCC Dairy after the payment of original invoice. Number five of the conclusion of the forensic audit, $39,802 is unpaid pass-through expenses as of December 31st, 2007. These items are recorded as a receivable and appear to have been invoiced, but were not paid as of this date. Justice's earlier question regarding what happened in 2001, was the whole board wiped out? No, the whole board was not wiped out. If you go back to what happened in 2001, it was Munson, Pearson, and Heitman, who are plaintiffs, who were removed. Some of the other majority shareholders, who are appellees in this case, remained board members at that time. There's nothing in the record that indicates anything, is what we've heard for the last 20 minutes. And all the citations are on page 29 of my appellate brief. Mario Solis, someone was retained to serve as an operation manager for NCC Dairy and two other dairies. Unclear who paid the salary. The following notation was put on a February 27, 2007 invoice. None of this was MCC's, but MCC, but as usual, MCC paid, with a notation from the bookkeeper. MCC was billed for wet feed, utilized by other dairies. They picked up the tab. Feed is the most expensive part of a dairy operation, and they're paying some of these expenses for other dairies. On page 30 of my brief, Barb Glutton stated, looks like we have an extra 218 tons of glutton that has vanished from MCC. Here's the activity report for October feed. I'm sorry that it came out again. If everyone would just be a little more careful, we would not have these issues. I guess I'm going to have to crack the whip. MCC, you see in the record, went ahead and picked up housing costs for employees that weren't necessarily working for them, but were working for other dairies. They paid for consulting services. Fourth bullet, AR002-870, Exhibit 21. They paid for consulting services from competing dairies. AR002-870, Exhibit 26. They were billed for technical support to other dairies. AR02870, Exhibits 28 through 32. They picked up the tab, the vehicle allowance, for one of the appellees. AR002870. They assumed ownership of Veblen East. Took all ownership of all the feed, the cost of which was billed to MCC Dairy. AR002870. MCC Dairy paid for the parlor equipment at other dairies. AR002870, Exhibit 84. The original complaint was the source of depositions. The depositions that were being referenced were dealing with the original complaint. Again, the elements of the amended complaint are different than that of the original complaint. How can that deposition testimony be utilized here? One of the things I had a hard time understanding was just why and how does this work with MCC Dairy? You know, what were they picking this Prairie Ridge management where there was no segregation between the different dairies and they were the management company and the appellants went ahead and just had an ownership interest in MCC, not the other? But you can go ahead and see that there were fresh cows to replace the culls, the deads and the dries, where that came out of MCC Dairy. The pregnant cows, 60 days prior to lactating, how they were rotated through MCC Dairy. So MCC Dairy, during a lot of these times, is picking up the tab and the operating costs for this necessary function within all the other dairies. You see how, with MCC Dairies, how pregnant heifers in this integrated system were sold. All calves were sold at less than a day old to another competing interest. You've got this dry lot when the cows aren't lactating that MCC Dairy is picking up the tab for. That is in the record. Those pass-through expenses that are talked about in the forensic audit, those are in the record.
But what if the record says they're improper? What person said they were improper? Yeah, the pass-through expenses occurred. But who in the record said that was illegal?
Whether or not it was a breach of the fiduciary duty?
Yeah, what witness said that?
In my brief, Justice...
No, I'm asking what witness said that was illegal.
When you look at the forensic audit, and I need to mention this, of course there was no finding of fraud in the forensic audit, because what it says exactly, the exact wording in the forensic audit, is additionally no specific findings of fraud are determined by this report. All determination of fraud must be determined in a court of law. That's part of the conclusion of the forensic audit. The forensic audit, or it's kind of boilerplate or something that they put in their report where they say, I'm not going to find anything illegal. Here are the facts, and then you take those facts to a court and make a determination whether or not they're illegal. And Justice, that's on page, that statement is on page 12 of 12 of the and it's in the conclusion of the report.
All right.
That's what the trial is for. That's what we're here for.
Ordinarily, in these kinds of circumstances, none of us are cattlemen, or we're not dairymen. We don't know what's appropriate in a consortium of dairies, whether you're supposed to do this or not. These are the kinds of cases where you call in an expert who says, I'm an experienced, or I'm a professor of this, or whatever, and I've looked at the audit, and I've looked at these things, and these things are improper. You lay all these things out about, how does a jury know whether that's right or wrong? You say it's wrong, they say it's right, there's no wrongdoing. Where's the expertise that's going to help us make that decision?
Yeah, and there's a disputed material factor, Justice, and our burden in Tolley v. Lev in this court, justices, was a party resisting summary judgment is required to show that they will be able to place sufficient evidence in the record at trial to support findings on all elements which they have the burden of proof. And then the non-moving party, as the court knows, must present specific findings showing that a genuine material fact is at issue for trial. And then the affidavits, deposition, testimony, and this came out of Richard B. Lentz, 539 Northwest 2nd 80, must be viewed in light most favorable to the non-moving party, and reasonable doubts should be resolved against the moving party. So yeah, they said, we said, that those are supposed to be resolved in our particular interest and let this matter proceed forward. Any other questions, Justices?
It's not.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Salmon. Appreciate it. The court will be in recess.